So we're going to a document that we didn't finish last week, where McLuhan is in a high-level committee meeting with the board of the University of Toronto on February 28, 1969, and they're arguing with the student representatives. Seems to be Bob Ray and maybe someone named Webster. Not sure if Webster is a student leader, but perhaps. But we know Bob Ray is. And McLuhan has been mocking Bob Ray as a return to the tribal invader. And his peers, the guys his age, are laughing at that, but Bob Ray is finding it hard to understand what McLuhan's getting at. He also wants McLuhan to stop being so abstract, as Lynette complained about me, and get more practical. Deal with whatever Bob Ray thinks.
Bob. Not bad. It's entertaining.
Okay, good. I was just making a dig. Why not? You're there to be dug. Okay, so I'll just read a little bit from before to overlap. So we bring up the screen enlargement. So a guy named Webster, or maybe it is a student, and this might be the kind of question the student leader would ask. He says, how would you explain a mood of conservatism among the vast majority of our young people? I don't know if a younger person would say our young people, but he might be wondering why they don't react to his radical stimulus. So McLuhan says, well, it's very simple. They're finished with this highly fragmented situation. They want involvement. They're finished with the highly fragmented, specialized life. They want a closely knit, coherent life with deep involvement with all their senses and all their personal relationships, which is impossible. He said you can't get this deep involvement that the kids who, citing Paul Goodman's book, Growing Up Absurd, a book in the 60s, as what the baby boomers were experiencing. Under civilization, we deliberately create detachment and distance from one another. See that? That's banking, Susanna. Create detachment and distance and property ownership and picket fences. You got that? Well, maybe you're on mute. That is civilization, objectivity and detachment, whereas the new electric crowd want involvement, interface, and that includes abrupt interface, and closeness. And so they're prepared to go back to the most primitive conditions of life. And he cites the Esalen Institute, Big Sur. Big Sur, they'll go back and scratch the soil and eat berries and make their own clothes. And we're only beginning to see this happen. The kids coming up, the 14-year-olds, are going to take to this kind of Big Sur on a much bigger scale than the first long-haired bunch. Now, that didn't happen. The younger brothers and sisters and that, they were sort of went back to school and got into getting their degrees. They knew it was robotic, but the trend was not to drop out too much. And so McLuhan's saying the first effect of black and white and then color TV is people yearning for the deep involvement, which is their brains are yearning for it because it's being affected by the screen, but the person doesn't know that's why they want deep involvement, and they don't recognize that yearning is going to be frustrated by the huge industrial backlog, which is very hard to get rid of. Yes?
Do you have a date for when this was written, Bob?
Well, this is a transcription of a meeting, as I said, February 28th, 1969.
Thank you.
So McLuhan talks about the yearnings of the first long-haired bunch who don't know where their yearnings come from. And, of course, none of them got to be deliberately deeply involved in the chemical body. They end up being very involved in their professions, in their specialist lives. They got jobs and did specialisms and became fanatic, coke-taking jerk-offs, what they call yuppies. They became fascist in the old sense, and about what they do and about their lifestyle, and they're not going to give it up. And they kept acquiring new gadgets to prop their flagging continuously eroded identities by this contradictory situation. So Webster asked McLuhan for that explanation, and Webster says, what about the ones that aren't long-haired? I mean, we activists, see, he's calling himself activist. That's why he seems to be a student leader. I mean, we activists are faced with a vast mass of apathetic, turned-off people. How do you explain this in terms of electronic culture? Now, McLuhan might have said that you, in an electronic culture, you don't match as much with other people. You go off and make your own space, like people did with drugs. Let's see if he says something like that. McLuhan says, well, the turned-off people, as I say, the somnambulists. Note he's using the word somnambulist here, implies negatively. The somnambulists, the people who don't feel adequate to accommodating themselves to very fast change, so they tune out. He doesn't say tune out. And if they don't feel themselves adequate to accommodating themselves to very fast change, will naturally try to consolidate and sleep it out. Oh, well, you know, I'll sit this one out, he quotes the street saying. I remember a couple of people when Trump was elected, they said, wake me in 2020. They willingly wanted to go to sleep. But the activists are really without any goals. So he's now telling you, this activist, that you really don't have any goals. But the activists are really without any goals, any objectives at all, except to do what the old boys are already doing. And they just want some of it. In other words, they want to get on the old committees. And McLuhan says in another article back then that don't try to take over the university or whatever as an activist. You'll just end up sitting all day on committees, which is true. And McLuhan said in general that government went from democracy to government by committee. In the sort of, that's the closest Western man could get to a group hive mind, was have a committee.
Yeah.
And then you have the conspiratorial fantasies or facts that there are committees in the secret intelligence levels are running things. But it's still a committee. As McLuhan would say, a committee of utterly unlike entities. That would be mafia, military, and bankers all together. Different kinds of personalities, say, or skills. They'd all be forced to be on the committee. So he's saying the activists just want to replay the old past. And this, of course, says McLuhan, is a total loss of imagination and represents no effort at all of investigation or understanding in their part. So he's saying the activists are dumb, stupid. Abby Hoffman is a screw-up. Then he says, I think they want attention. They want to suffer. They'll do anything that'll create some sort of a discomfort to suffer. So he thinks the activists actually just want to create problems and suffer. So then Bob Ray, the other student activist who goes on to become a premier of the Ontario province in 1990, Bob Ray says, what about politics? Where does all this fit in? Is that all considered rather old-fashioned? McLuhan says, you can see, for example, that the ballot box doesn't work under electronic conditions. As a way of discovering images to represent people, the Americans now know that the ballot box will not do it. Representation like this failed as TV came in. Representative government in that sense in the United States is finished. So what people mean by democracy was finished 50 years ago. Then he says, but I mean, this doesn't mean it isn't going to go on. And it did go on. Hollow echoes as the Android meme snuck up on everybody. So Webster says, what about the politics of confrontation? The politics of, and Bob Ray interrupts and says, I'm sorry, what about ideology? Do you think? Okay, so that's the end of that page. I've got to go to the next page. So bear with me for a second while I get the next page out.
So that wasn't the end of the sentence.
No.
Back, do you think?
Right. Bob Ray says, I'm sorry, what about ideology? Do you think? And then we get to the next page.
Before you leave that page, Bob, will you reread the first sentence when McLuhan answered that question, what about politics? Just the first statement that he made.
Okay. Yeah, you mean the question, how do you explain the apathetic, turned-off people?
Yeah, was that
the... Oh, no, no. Bob Ray goes, what about politics? Where does this all fit in, right?
Yes.
And he says, McLuhan says, you can see, for example, that the ballot box doesn't work under electronic conditions. So politics for McLuhan is the electoral process. I guess Bob Ray means that. And McLuhan says that electoral process or the ballot box does not impact in government anymore. It's the politician's image which is more important than any ideas he has or any kind of representing things, because he's going to have to respond to the changing images in the environment a lot, and that, in retrospect, will make them look like they contradict themselves. They're not contradicting themselves.
So he was relating the ballot box, the vote, to the politician's image, to the image they portray.
The image was more powerful than anything that's meaningful about ballot box democracy. You're voting for personalities, for chemical bodies, for ideas, for platforms. And yeah. McLuhan says there's too much turnover of imagery every day. We live 200 years every 12 months. So the politician is going to appear to be contradicting himself, as he has to adopt a different posture so that his image is resonant with the hidden ground or the visible ground in the news that everybody is asking momentarily to respond to. See, so you don't go in with an idea and stay devoted to that idea and keep bashing that idea against all these changing grounds, changing context, changing effects in the global theater.
Yeah.
You just find out where the public's at, what is the issue, you know, by taking polls, and then you claim to be that image. You get in front of the parade once you found out the parade is going in a certain direction. And then you got to do that every 6 months.
So that explains every broken campaign promise.
Yeah.
Every president.
The campaign promises are not relevant at all. That's why the debates kind of took over, these silly debates where they don't really get into details. They just sort of bash images of each other, of their past record, up against the new images that the population thinks they want. That's why the debates are kind of superficial, but they're not superficial in terms of maintaining your image. That's what McLuhan called it. Press the pants barrels. When the Carter-Ford debate collapsed and the broadcasting stopped functioning, and McLuhan said the guys behind the scene creating the environment came out like, you know, Beatles from the woodwork, and had to fix the wires for about 25 minutes or maybe 22 minutes. And while they were doing that, Ford and Carter stood there frozen, didn't know what to say. Yeah. And so McLuhan had this metaphor that they were like standing in old-fashioned barrels getting their pants pressed. Press the pants barrels, he said.
Just waiting for waiting for their pants to be done before they moved or talked or did anything.
Right. Okay, so can I move on now?
Yeah.
That's been explained. Yes. What about then, Webster says, what about the politics of confrontation, which is what the student radicals would be into? Do you laugh, Carol?
No.
The politics of, Bob Ray interrupts him and says, I'm sorry, what about ideology? Do you think, and that gets cut off, and McLuhan answers it before Bob Ray is going to say something else. But McLuhan addresses the issue, you know, what about ideology? So McLuhan says, ideologies, for example, Marxism represents a mid-19th century doctrine. We've passed Marxism reality. All the dreams of Marxism were passed by ordinary capitalist society 100 years ago. So by the 1860s, by the time the Maximilian took over Mexico. In other words, real communism existed in Marx's own time. That is, when ordinary people had access to services that the richest man in the world couldn't buy. When any working man could buy trips and information and other services that the richest man in the world or who had ever lived in the world couldn't have. That was communism. Couldn't have for themselves, I'd add. That was communism, and that happened by 1830, long before Marx. Now, he's talking about new railways, newspapers, steamships, all kinds of technological developments that allowed anybody to move around on them relatively cheaply. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then McCone says, in the electric age, everybody, regardless of his means, has free access to multi-billion dollar services. This would be television, for example. This surpasses all the dreams of Marx and Lenin. All that Russia, for example.
Apps.
What?
All the apps you were talking about.
Apps.
The apps. Yeah, you have all these corporations in the palm of your hand.
Yes, yes. That's now. But we're talking 50 years ago when it was one-way broadcast media. All right? This is him saying in 69 that, this is before pay TV, people could engage television for just a few pennies. Buy your set and then just pay what your electric bill. And other people could huddle, he would say, in Grand Central Station and watch the TVs there. So he had relatively free access to multi-billion dollar services, the TV companies, and movies and other media. This surpasses all the dreams of Marx and Lenin. All that Russia, for example, is trying to do is to have a 19th century. They're not even trying for a 20th century. So Russia is trying to get a hardware economy going in the 20s. And they're trying to have redo the 19th century. That's why they like to be Marxists. Marx, being a 19th century philosophy, it propped up the goal of hiding in the past. And McLuhan said, and communism is an old 19th century thing that we bypassed 100 years ago. This is typical of radicals and utopians. They always live a way, way back. Like you people trying to get that mountain gene. Radicals, utopians. You lived way, way back in trying to save the mountain. Now, sometimes, what?
Great value to the people who grew up there. It was memorable. They wanted to keep it the way it looked.
Right.
Its image, yeah.
Do they still have it?
No, it's being dynamited on a regular basis. It's still there, but it's going to take 100 years, so they have a while to, acclimate to it.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, their families are eroding to the mountain of the internet, inner and outer space, the huge mountain, the giant.
That whole community that they wanted to preserve as a rural agricultural township, is that nobody can make money in the traditional agricultural way, milking cows or growing crops.
Do they still do that?
I think there may still be a few families that are still doing it, but it just dwindles. It's down to very, very few that are left.
Hmm.
And then big, I wouldn't call them corporate farms, but they're big farmers in the area that will buy the land and then farm because they've got the big equipment.
That's happening. It's being absorbed into the bigger farms.
Yes, the bigger farmers that have land all over the place.
And these big farmers, are they members of local churches? Are they going to take care of these people they put out of work? And they're going to help them?
I can't speak for how much they contribute. They're local. I know a couple.
Yeah, yeah.
They're neighbor. They're good neighbors. One of the big farmers still paid my field during the whole controversy, the whole thing. We got along very well, actually, and we were on opposing sides. He paid for the lawyer on the other side. But by that time, the impact, we both realized how much it was a much bigger impact and effect on the entire neighborhood than anyone expected, mm-hmm. that we were pitting neighbors against neighbors by that time. That's what destroyed the community more than anything, was the fight to save the mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so someone's moving stuff around. If you're going to move stuff around, mute so I can not have the words blocked out.
But okay, getting so back where, to 69, yeah, I'm thinking TV was free, phones, telephones were free. There was no payment for that, and that was the new technology.
The new communism. That McLuhan called that software communism.
Because it was
the
wired.
The new hive. Wired, yeah. So Webster says, what about capitalists? Are they living in the future? McLuhan says, no, they're somnambulating and just tranquilizing as best they can. So Lynch, who may be an adult, says to the head of the discussion, Arthur Porter, or is it Lynch? Can't remember, Lynch or Arthur Porter, but they're both authoritative kind of guys. Arthur, says Lynch, I wonder whether you'd like to elaborate on a point you just touched on at the beginning of your remarks. You commented on the lack of ladies on the commission, and it has always been our regret as well, for perhaps not as theoretical a reason as you've given, but, McLuhan says, I gave Arthur a very interesting statistic on this subject. Since the invasion of Alaska, the space occupied by women has been reduced by one-third, and there's laughter. And he says, this really entitles them to a much larger representation on governing bodies. Now, he doesn't complete the statement about how women have reduced themselves by one side, by one-third. He says in other speeches, they did it by buying elastic products. Elastic tightened the women's space up. The space occupied by women has been reduced by one-third, he says, thanks to elastic. Elastic clothes, and Carolyn's laughing a bit there. Cynically. This really entitles them to a much larger representation on governing bodies. Now, he took
pantyhose.
That statement. What?
I was thinking of pantyhose.
Carolyn. Yeah. So they laugh. The board laughs at that, even though they don't hear the whole joke. But maybe they've heard McLuhan say the joke before, or... it's just funny saying the space they're occupying has been reduced. Well, that would mean they got thinner, you know, following the Twiggy fad. I don't know.
No, they're using elastic girdles and pantyhose to suck it in.
Yeah, and that was a new thing in the 60s?
I don't know. I mean, before that, it was whalebone, and they were always trying to suck it in.
Okay.
You know, the whole
reduce
business
the
about...
waste. Reduce the waste.
Yeah, or the appearance of weight. Like, when I read some of these historical novels, women are tightening themselves into this whale bone. They call them stays, S-T-A-Y-S. It's like the scaffolding of a building that they tape around themselves and tie themselves in. Their maids put their... a foot on their back and tighten up these things. And that's why women were accused of fainting all the time because they couldn't breathe. It's horrible. So there.
Okay. We have a new caller from Santa Ana. Do you want to speak?
Well, I was just listening. This is the first time I'm calling, so I'm very interested.
What aspect are you interested in? We offer a lot of different things on the show. What part are you interested in?
Oh, I'm just interested in anything. I just like to learn and be educated on everything I can be taught or listened to.
So you've heard us before?
Yes.
Okay, so you know we're educational. We got a lot of different things to say. All right, okay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so you don't have any opinion or anything you want to express right now?
Right now, no. I'm just got in and just want to listen a little bit.
Yeah, we're reading transcripts of Marshall McLuhan with his fellow board members at the University of Toronto in 69 when they're dealing with the student protests and seeing what McLuhan, the greatest mind of the second half of the 20th century, says to the students and to his fellow board members. That's what we're listening to. Okay. And if you can, you can mute your phone so we don't hear environmental noises while you're listening.
How?
What kind of phone do you have?
Oh, okay.
The no mute button there on your phone? Hmm?
Looking.
Did you find it?
Looking.
Okay.
Maybe she
so,
muted herself. Oh,
yeah.
No.
Let's
but
assume that.
You can
that.
Unmute when you have a comment. That's the other
Yeah, unmute when you want to say something. And we welcome any comments. So we're talking about the effect of elastic on women. Space in the world is reduced by one-third. So Lynch says, I was really wanting Arthur to continue what he was suggesting about the impact of computers. You said something about children talking to computers, and it dropped with that. Would you pick it up from there and tell us what this meant in terms of content of education? So Arthur says, I think it's not merely a question of content of education. I think this is the emergence of a new culture. I would say if we're not on the verge right now of a renaissance, then we're very much missing the boat. Now, this guy, he ran McLuhan's Center for Culture and Technology in 67, 68 when McLuhan was in New York City at Fordham University. And I've read an interview, too, with him, and he's, like, taking the positive side of McLuhan. He's very influenced by McLuhan. So he was when he says, I would say if we're not on the verge right now of a renaissance, then we're very much missing the boat. I mean, this is the next greatest invention of man after the printing press. He's talking about the computer. I mean, without question, this is the real extension of man's central nervous system. And what we're playing around with now is trying to figure out what its tremendous capabilities are. We're just playing. The humanities and the social scientists are scarcely aware that these machines exist. And yet in the future, one can visualize, perhaps within 10, 20 years, the utilization in the humanities will perhaps be far greater than even in the scientists. I can see this because new languages are going to emerge and new processes, new interfaces. This whole concept of computer graphics, it's going to transform the whole business of education. This isn't a question of computer age instruction. That's gone already. That's passé, certainly as far as the university is concerned. So we're moving into a real man-machine cycliosis, or maybe means symbiosis, in a very real sense, with new language, with the possibility of associative memory. So McLuhan perhaps cuts him off, but starts saying, and continuing Porter's thoughts, which might imply the extension of consciousness itself as an environmental fact. Collective consciousness might be technologically extended instead of all these little itsy-bitsy particular machines processing all data. If you extend consciousness itself, we've already extended the nervous system. Now we got to get the next page.
Ooh. This is good.
You've already extended. What? Someone saying something?
Good. I said this is good.
Okay. Kind of ionic here when he's talking about the extension of consciousness.
Yeah.
So.
Although Ion would say that there is no unconsciousness.
Consciousness. Or unconscious or consciousness. That's right. Well, but look at this. McLuhan said that when you extend your eye with the book, it numbs the eye. It extends it, but it also causes a numbing to what's happening. So when we extend our central nervous system, we numbed it. And that may be why people start taking drugs to activate the central nervous system, to refeel it. So if we extend consciousness, that'll numb consciousness. And that's what Ion is saying. So Ion, perversely, in my terms, is agreeing with McLuhan, because this is 50 years later, and there's some kind of weird consciousness or expansion going on right now in the Android meme and post-Android meme, so why not call it consciousness? And that's why everybody is numb and in a whatever state of being. So he says, though, the extension of consciousness after the extension of the central nervous system, this will create its own problems. That basically it has happened already because we have to take all knowledge for our province. We have to take the entire world as a unit for government. And I think the entire planet has become a campus. There's no use regarding any other dimension as a serious campus except the planet itself. Now what's funny is when I read this, he's saying it, but these are paragraphs from his books. So his books are just what he says in conversation.
In the meetings. In a board meeting.
Yeah. So what he performs, it's translated into all different media. It's sort of like a basic unit. that goes into speech, goes into TV, goes into radio, goes into newspaper articles, goes into letters. He is using different media for, you can't say a limited range of content, but a particular theme. The meaning is the message today.
He can apply it everywhere. He can apply it to,
yeah,
to multiple subjects. When the question,
he's always having the same conversation with himself and others, regardless of the environment, of the situation he's in. He's always thinking the same things. We're looking at the same issues, and he has standard answers for them all. So this guy wanted to know what was coming, and McLuhan goes into this. If the guy had not heard it before, he'd be reeling a bit from what McLuhan just said about the extension of consciousness that will create its own problems. So Lynch says, but did I gather from Arthur's comment, though, that he saw a radical change between the TV child and the computer child? This last comment seems to me that you're talking about an extension of these two, of both of them. So there's the extension of TV, extension of the computer, and then the extension of consciousness. So McLuhan says, the TV child, though, tends to be crammed with the old data. Yes, the children in sensory terms are living in the advanced present, but their thinking is forced to be 19th century data that they get in their education. So he says the TV child, though, tends to be crammed with the old data, regardless of whether it's a TV child or a computer child. So Porter says, that's right. You see, TV, the communication media, the form of TV is one way, and this leads... And then he's cut off, and Lynch says, this is your point. And then Porter comes back and says, this is the key. This is a two-way. This is a real viable interaction, and this means the key thing in education we're looking for, I feel quite sure. We're looking at it the wrong way around. We ought, I am certain, what we should be doing right now is teaching the computer, and by teaching the computer, this is the teacher, this is the teaching environment too, if you like. This is the real learning process, so that what one visualizes them interacting with new and exciting and highly imaginative languages and sort of, here you've got this neuronic device. Well, just imagine the idea of teaching first-year psychology. I mean, it's just tremendous. Let's see who's making that noise. Who's serving themselves stuff. I can't see. It's nothing showing up at this moment. Mute yourself if you're... not aware of it. So he's saying, talking about new ways of teaching psychology. And it might not be teaching in the old sense. He might say exploring psychology. And he says it's tremendous. And you'll the potential of computers. And you'll find, and I've seen this time and time again, that the excitement of students interacting this way, just to walk across into the old physics building, can't remember its new name, and see this really people sort of lining up. But this is at present very lineal, very sequential, using the things from the old technologies and so on. But I'm talking about the new environment, and these are things that kids will use. Right today in California, in certain California schools, and in Oregon, the elements of Secony, which a mere 15 years ago was, I don't know what Secony is or what he's saying, might be a misprint, the elements of Secony, which a mere 15 years ago was, well, it's graduate level work in mathematics, it's being put across to grades 5 and 6. So he's saying university content is happening to public school, 5 and 6, the grades. So you just see through this sort of computer interacting. So he's saying you see through it. So this is the revolution as I see it. He sees you seeing through, seeing what's going on a larger formal basis. Then McLuhan says, if you have the whole world, a total field to work in, and then he says field, in quotes, field, after all, is a Norman term out of physics. If you have the whole planet as field, then the role of student is hunter. The condition of the student today is to return to the condition of hunter. Now, the hunter is never a specialist. He never studied anything. You have to take the total environment as a subject. And this, I think, is an inevitable consequence of speed-ups, of total field, And the student's role is not to acquire classified data about any part of that field, but to be a hunter in that field. Not saying what you hunt for. I guess you would hunt for pattern recognitions, not just isolated data. So, with that.
Wow.
Now, that's what happened with the internet world. So, in a way, McLuhan's predicting, not predicting, but he's talking about the Android meme world.
Yeah. It's so applicable to now. And it reminds me when we were talking earlier, and I was talking about, you know, electric cars and self-driving cars taking over. Well, McLuhan's talking about what's happening now, and that was 50 years ago that he's talking about it.
Yeah.
But his approach is the only one that can really give you some type of understanding, because you have to see into the effects of so many different things, not
yeah.
just one aspect.
And that's exactly what he's describing, is you have to be a hunter. If the field is your planet, you become the hunter.
Yeah.
We are into Saint Eustache.
Into what?
Say that again.
Saint Eustache is the same patron of hunters.
Saint
no,
the
church.
The patron.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
the church
yeah.
in France that
yes.
was ruled by Frank the First.
And that's the one that had the big organ.
That
yeah.
darn Francis the First. It always comes back to Francis the First.
That's such an important guy.
I think he knew, because he knew that the Hermetic tradition is about putting all this information everywhere.
Oh,
yeah.
You're reminding me now, Roxy, of the heyday that you talked about this. Yeah, go on.
Yes, he knew that this is something somebody is going to do someday. They're going to look into his castles and start
hunting,
learning what he was really doing with Leonardo.
And Ofenel.
Well,
because Ofenel's guidance.
Boab,
yeah.
I can imagine Leonardo and he looking into your bottle.
Yes.
like that was the first clue for me.
Yes.
And then we...
They were looking at this bottle they found in the kitchen. They go, did you bring this here? Frank said, no, I've never seen it before. Leonardo says, neither have I. Well, how'd it get here? What's it look like? What is it? Let's take some sip of it. No, says Leonardo. I'm an old man. I can't afford an LSD trip at this age. Frank says, well, I'll take it. So Frank took a sip, and he disappeared.
Because you don't...
Oh, wow.
there are many legends about Leonardo and Frank the First, and they were very tall and very strong. So maybe they were in the drops.
yeah. They had extra powerful bodies.
The little
boy. Yeah.
So it's interesting that McLuhan is describing the Android meme in a way. And he doesn't, well, I can't say he doesn't know it. But when Wired magazine came out in 93, they looked at some of his writing and said, this guy seems to be describing us in the 90s. So they made him a patron saint. But you could... It's valuable to read McLuhan even now to get some of these thoughts that you never thought about, because you don't realize how much you're in 19th century thinking. So you catch up a bit with McLuhan, and then you are able to see what McLuhan didn't talk about, what his language doesn't deal with, which I would say is the five bodies. But you still learn from McLuhan. You guys are listening, you're learning. You're hearing ideas you never heard before. Right?
Yes, because it's sometimes what I like to do is to read McLuhan, and it doesn't matter if he's talking about the telephone or the TV or whatever. It's the way of learning how to make these connections, of how to
yeah.
explore and how to apply this to other mediums or to other technologies. It's not
right. That's the basic lesson. That's what McLuhan wants you to learn. He wants you to say, okay, the telephone came in. What was happening in poetry at the time of the telephone? What was happening in shipping? What was happening in business, in the military? You just go across the institutions of the mortar world of society, and you'll see that there were radical changes in different ways with different purposes at the time some technology came in, new technology.
Yes, and sometimes things that may seem irrelevant or not so important, like when he talks about the invention of these things to go on the horse. I don't remember the word.
Talking about the invent the horse buggy?
No, the thing the
stirrup. The stirrup.
Yes, stirrup, that thing.
Yeah.
And that how thing. That created the whole medieval system with the Lord. Yes.
Yeah.
Because that has allowed a man to go with full armor on top of a horse and defend the people. And that
defend the people.
The feudal system. And it's like, wow.
So obvious. It's obvious. Yeah, you know, you have those medieval jobs like iron workers and, I mean, you know, those guys that hammer the horseshoes and all that. Those images of medieval jobs or professions were caused by the stirrup. And now the images of these specialties don't say, hey, we're here because of the stirrup. You have to read and you have to find out that the stirrup is the reason those professions happened.
Yes, and many people, most people, even people in economy, don't know that the banking is a result and effect of the printing press.
Yeah. They don't, you know, people just scrambling to be comfortable or to get comfortable. And that's the problem of the sensory life, making all these demands of people. So they don't have time to think. They just quickly get out of school, get a job, and start hoping to make money or conspiring to do crime that gets them money, you know? That's the main unconscious, somnambulistic response. They don't go around saying, what is this system? I'm working in a bank. Where did this start? And if they do read some history, they'll just get content history, not what McLuhan
but
called the language of form.
That's the source of all our problems. People think everything is about making money.
Yeah.
And they think it's about staying alive. Well, they work to make money or they want to learn something to make money. Everything is that. And this is where we are now.
Yeah.
I've brought you to this dire state.
The population of the world is in debt, and people think they have some account.
Yeah. So they've just registered to become a debtor. I guess that's a creditor, right, Gene? When you're in debt, you're a creditor.
Well, I mean, that's the fascinating thing about accounting. When you're a bank, it's reversed.
So, right.
Yeah. If you,
I don't know what we are.
If you owe someone, then it's a credit. You're a creditor. But,
right.
But a debit is made to a bank account when you sign up for a bank account. You know, that's your debit.
That was the big thing in Plato that man is in this cave and we are not really perceiving what's going on and we're like slaves in the cave, in the darkness.
Banking accounting is like the mirror image of business accounting or making money. Holding money is the mirror image of making money.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to move into this some more.
Well, just one more thing about McLuhan. It what you read continues to astound me as to how it seemed to have come just natural. There was something, a knowing that McLuhan had that was so ingrained and natural that he could also joke about, you know, throw in wit,
yeah,
you know, little witty comments and jokes that people didn't even get because they were still trying to take in what he had said the sentence before.
And they were trying to write little poems, little sonnets, little abstract patterns on their page. And here's McLuhan was creating the new poetry, the new role of the traditional poet. He was asked to speak all over the place. He actually appeared to know something that people thought was important. He could express himself in all these different media. That would be a post-Finnegan's Wake poetry. Not a guy like Ginsberg ranting and writing little poem books. Not like Leonard Cohen or even Dylan making songs.
Yes, because the inspiration is not the moon or the flower or
right.
the girlfriend. It's the whole environment.
The planet.
Yeah.
The field is the planet.
Yeah. The planet becomes an art form. You know, when I'm rereading this stuff, it's reminding me of how good McLuhan is. If you see that he... Where does poetry go after T.S. Eliot and Finnegan's Wake? Well, it doesn't stay limited to the book world. It starts looking at the huge environments that are being built right in front of everybody as objects that you write a poem about. But he could talk his poem. He could do seminars on it. The whole expression. And when the spaceship, when they land on the moon, he turns that immediately into a significant art form and explains its effects. Like the old critics would do with a painting, you know? He did it on a massive scale, which in retrospect is the what you would talk about after World War II. You wouldn't wrap...
And he was such a genius that he could summarize everything in one-liners like a nut. Or like a bear's. Like, the medium is the message. It's really like the most amazing poem ever.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
most amazing haiku that explains all of humanity.
Right, and there's four levels to it, if you want to get into it. It's message, massage, then mess age, it's the mess age, and then it's the mass age.
Mass.
Four meanings in his poem.
Yeah.
And he's being brief. You know, he's not writing long stuff that you sit around and wait and have to listen to. You're being harassed by the environment, you don't have much time, so he condensed his works. In many ways. He calls it the aphoristic style, the aphorism. And then the aphorism came in as a trend in rock music. Dylan made aphorisms. People started, you know, quoting these neat phrases, neat sentences, which they didn't do so much. Well, maybe they did, but it seems that it wasn't as widespread before World War II as it was after. So rock music was a total symptom of the larger pattern that McLuhan was talking about. So everybody was a subset of McLuhan's poem, doing aspects of it.
What's the difference between a cliche and an aphorism?
Not much difference. An aphorism can be something that's never heard before, but after a while, if it takes... and becomes popular, then it becomes a cliche. So then there's all kinds of cliche aphorisms in Finney's Wake that Joyce reversed. That was part of what McLuhan especially, they would take cliches. No one ever thought of altering the cliches too much, you know. They were sacred, these cliches. Everybody appeared smart enough if you knew them and could say them. But Joyce started really playing with them. And saying them differently. The same aphorism, you know, he changed the words. Like that famous aphorism or cliche, necessity is the mother of invention. Right?
You were
Everybody
trying
heard
you
that.
Were trying to do one earlier, right? You were trying to change the people make a path to your door.
Yes. Now they beat a path, that means they try to stop the path. They beat the damn path. And put up blockades and FDA rules.
No,
but,
beating a path is like beating down the grass so that there's a path. If you're in a field or if you have to go from my door to your door and there's a field, that's beating a path to my door.
But I was changing it to beat its path. I changed it. I don't know if I said exactly that.
I thought you were trying
what,
to
what I made this up last night.
Each other up. Yeah, it's something about
yeah, I was trying to what whoever I said it, if people were beating each other up on the path to your doorstep.
There we go. That's it.
But there is the phrase, or I think it's a verse by T.S. Eliot. I'm not sure now. The consequences of the image is the image of the consequences, how it is.
No, that's Hertz, the inventor of radio. His law of complementarity. The consequence of the image, so a new image, a new phenomenon happens. It has an effect on you so that you don't see that image. Because the consequence of the image is to project the images of the what is it? The consequence of the image is the images of the consequence. So there are consequences, but the way you see it are conditioned by the image. So you're seeing the images of the consequences determined by the original environment or image. So the image of the consequences is the consequences of the image.
Yes.
I just found it.
So, Hertz was the greatest poet after McLuhan.
Who was?
Hertz.
Who? Yeah, Hertz. Hertz. Yes, Hertz. Yes. The image of the consequences is the consequences of the image.
No, well, here it's the consequence of the images will be the image of the consequences.
I don't know. I can't follow it anymore. You said it too many times. I know it begins. I had to memorize it.
I put it in chat because I have to look at the words.
Yes, but I memorized it by saying the word image comes first. This is 50 years ago when I memorized it. It was in cliché to archetype, and I liked it. So I always begin with the image, and it makes sense. The image, the effect of the consequences of an affecting image is the images of the consequences. So there are consequences, and those consequences condition you to see the image darkly, erroneously, differently from what it is.
Okay, so then, all right, you're describing the consequence of the images will be the image of the consequence.
No, I begin with the word image. The image of the consequences, what you see, is a result of the mesmerism that the image does on you, so you look at it through the rearview mirror, and you don't actually see what the image is.
So the image of the consequences will be the consequence of the image.
Is the consequences of the image.
It's been flipped.
That's the medium is the message. That's another way of saying the medium is the message. See, so there were different people came up with pretty good approximate stations of the medium is the message, but they never applied it to the new environments. It was just a thought. Literate man was still stuck in his head. McLuhan stopped thinking metaphorically and started looking around. He used to talk about Wyndham Lewis would go over and see his buddy's painting, a fellow artist. And he would come over, and he'd stand in front of the new painting, stare at it for a long time, and then leave without making a comment. And his friend probably was looking to see what Lewis would say about it. But Lewis left. So when asked why didn't he have anything to say, he says a nonverbal art form requires a nonverbal response. You don't speak paintings, so you don't speak back to them. Paintings are visual, so he would look at them, study it, register the visual information, and leave silently.
Well,
isn't that neat?
Yes, that is, but that is what you see in...
Yeah, he's actually correcting. He's transcending the image of the consequence of the image. He was not going to translate it into a verbal thing. That wasn't relevant. He stayed focused on what the image was, the language of its form.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Had a thought. If I'm correct, and you don't have a pure understanding of what I'm saying, in other words, really get it, you'll argue with me with all kinds of words, picking apart the differences, And this is what Carolyn probably gets in medicine. She'll state what she can see happening, and people will filter it through their medical knowledge and ask her particular questions and try to organize the full impact of what it is and never quite get the full impact. You get that, what I mean, Carol?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I get that.
So, yeah, if you think of...
That's like what we were saying last week, where people never have a clue what the other person is saying because they see it, hear it through their own filters.
The consequences, and there would be all kinds of intellectual, emotional, sensory, sexual, movement, the five Gurdjieff centers of your makeup of how you respond to something.
Yeah.
And they're all filtered with your personal information or conditioning of what you associate with those particular aspects of response. So,
you know what? It takes a while. It takes for me personally, it took a few years just to immerse myself and listen before I could respond at all. And
listening without listening to your own chatter.
Yeah, you have to acclimate yourself to this environment and get a clue of what you guys are actually talking about first.
And because once you get it, as Roxy's discovering, it's quite exciting. So it's actually you can, like I've been doing for 30, 40 years, talking the same kind of insights because they're neat to get. So it's fun running it up the flagpole once a week, you know?
They don't sound like the same unless you reach some sort of, point where...
Acclimatization, as you say. Some familiarity with it.
Yeah. Then suddenly there's this, you've said it in just a slightly different way, or I'm in a different place, or I don't know. And then, bam, then it sticks. And then I can move on to the next thing, you know.
Yep. So what were we saying? How did we get into this discussion?
Oh, hermetics and
medieval stuff? Oh, yeah, the stirrup.
Stirrup and...
The stirrup is a good example.
Yeah. And McLuhan's ability to point these things out and apply them.
Right. It seems to be that before the stirrup, people had this could be the Dark Ages, what we call the Dark Ages, but some people romanticize as an interesting post-Roman Empire world where there was a bit of freedom or not big armies of soldiers bugging you. So in that Dark Age, you weren't in the feudal system yet. You had to eke a living somehow, but there was a bit of freedom in that period. And then they vent the stirrup, and then they got the guy who might have protected you a little bit now has to protect you in a new context and be strong. So they got to make metallurgy industries and grow plants to feed the knight, and it becomes a big burden.
Okay. Now, you know I'm on this kick vibe about...
You become a slave, a serf. They weren't a serf in the Dark Ages.
Because in the Dark Ages, everybody was responsible for their own food production. They weren't dependent.
In a way, they were more tribal.
They were more responsible for their survival, for meeting their own survival need, you know, basics of survival. And I'm on this kick of what would be, we have no idea what we would be like if we didn't have to work to survive, to meet our needs.
Right.
Which is, my idea of any kind of system without money or, getting back to that. That's the other thing. There were people that probably were having difficulty, but then there were also people in areas where everything was lush and it was easy to produce and to meet their basic needs. Then you're not constrained in that way. Your creativity is not constrained in a way that we can't even imagine.
But isn't that what kids are expressing these days? They're existing with no responsibilities. It did used to be the kids had to do some chores and this and that, but they're totally living in a welfare state. They've got their smartphones that gives them all the information that makes them think that they're smarter than their parents. You know, all that stuff, it's really come to a head.
Yes, how is that different? I mean, that's we describe that as a numbing, that they're numbed and not feeling a sense of a need to be responsible for their own survival.
Right.
So how does that compare to...
Well, they're getting depressed because they have no purpose, it appears to me.
They have no way to develop all their energies. They don't know what to focus on.
Yeah, or, you know, express themselves by trying things and then failing. That all fell apart, too, where everybody had to win. You know, nobody could fail. And so kids really have no idea of what they're capable of. I think it's only homeschool kids that get a sense of that. But, you know, when most of, well, I don't know what the percentage is, but a lot of homeschooling is Christian-based. So, you know, they're getting programmed in, you know, lack of choice.
And probably traditional, more traditional ways as well.
Yeah, it's pretty neat what's happening to kids. That's where, you know, Bob's What Youth is, as it turns out, very important, timely activity. But Bob's back eating his popcorn now, so he's not going to talk. And I'm cutting up yellow beans.
Yellow beans.
Yellow beans.
And what are the yellow beans going into?
I'm just going to steam them, and I just got real hungry, so I'm going to make some lamb chops. And I might make Bob some, too.
Maybe, if he's a good boy.
If he's a good boy, well, no, I don't think that's ever going to happen. He's just Bob.
I'm not expecting any food to be given to me. Popcorn's about all I'm going to get.
Yeah, he'll ask for popcorn and some water, and that's it.
Yeah, give me some water, sir.
<All right.
laughs> Bob,
once
the medieval serf.
Yeah, once he starts asking for food, it's over.
Yeah, I have to be very careful here. I'm just a temporary roommate. You'd be evicted at any point.
You're just wonderfully surprised, Bob, when you get, you know, when the scraps are thrown to you. It just puts you in a very happy state all the time if you don't expect anything, right?
What did he say? I don't expect it. She said I don't.
You're just happily surprised when you.
Yeah, when anything happens, when anything's given to me, oh, I can live another 2 hours.
It's so funny. I'll make a pate. I'll make a pate, and I'll leave the dregs in the blender for Bob. And oh, can I have this?
I get all excited. Oh, boy, I can lick the dregs in the blender.
It's almost embarrassing.
Yeah. No, that's.
We would be the funniest
that
if
so
we
good.
Allowed it. What'd you say, G?
That stuff is so good. That's like cocaine. I get that.
I made it that weekend. Yeah, it was awesome.
If we allowed a camera in here, we'd be the funniest thing going, just people watching how we interacted.
The virtual reality show.
yeah. But it would be invasive of us. I think it would upset Carolyn that she'd be too visible. What she actually does, the little Hitler, the way she runs.
But going back to the effects of the cell phone.
The stirrup. Okay. The effects of
back
the stirrup.
Here we go. Yeah.
Well, the cell phone keeps staying on their rooms and doing nothing. Maybe the development will be really that they will need or they will want to get these chips so that these cell phones are part of their anatomy. It's not something.
Oh yeah, they'll want the beast to be put inside them. Yeah. That's what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They'd be so lazy.
And that they also will want to have this universal income, and they will then comply to accept this technology being implanted.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. We always wondered, you know, who on earth would want a chip in their head, but these lazy kids, oh, my thumb is tired.
Yeah. And so, by the way you just said that, what youth is fucking literally the best question? These kids aren't having a youth. I mean, it's even more evidence of what the title means, that article. They lay in their bed all summer. What youth? I ain't have no youth.
Yeah.
And Brent said that. He didn't have a body. So, too bad those kids can't find here and actually be interested enough in reality to enjoy a dialogue and learn something from it, you know. That you can't count on that.
You can't count on
them being interested.
I think that article that you read from that listed all the stuff that had no value, the car, you know, the Uber was the biggest company and had no cars.
Yeah.
I think, and it was in that article where they talked about 3D printing, and somewhere in Asia they're actually 3D printing a building. And I was thinking about that too. Food is close. I bet they're going to be 3D printing food at some point. So these kids in their rooms, all they have to do is hit the printer and eat their microwave burrito. You know?
Hit the printer. So Gene, you notice Trey, after a year or so absent, has shown up. What an asshole. He's trying to direct it to Kate, who he used to stalk, and to Chad. He's going, talking about Chad? You know, images of the consequence of the image. Then he says, you guys are talking about me, how interesting I am. And he goes, he's full of shit, too. Come kill me. And then we're just talking about, and then with the heart, well, he's covering his ass there. You know, he means that as a term of endearment. He's a guy who wants to be killed. He was suicidal for a while there. And then he says, you probably don't even know half the story anyway. See, so we're not qualified to talk. Well, as McClure would say, a half the truth or a half truth is a lot of truth for most people. So we don't need to know the whole story. We're already blowing your mind with half the truth.
That's a great aphorism.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Half truth is too much for most people.
Yeah.
No, the whole truth. Since people can't take the whole truth, they can only handle a half truth. And that's what he did. He took a half truth and made a big world out of it. The medium is the message. Because the other half, he revealed later, was the user is the content. And then another half would be the LaRouche point of view. Hey, people run the show. Management's in charge. And they don't care about any of the effects. Management causes the shit, not the medium.
The laws of media. The laws of media ecology. He preached
that. That's McLuhan's side. The other side is, no, humans create their own reality. And they're all scared. And management runs the shit out of them. And that's why we're all fucked up, because we're cowards. It's nothing to do with the aesthetics of language or form. So that would be maybe the dialectical view, the grammarian, the rhetorical view is McLuhan. And the other part of the trivium, the dialectical, is ideas and brute force are the causes of things. And, you know, that's partly true, right?
Brute force. Yeah.
Do you know that McLuhan said that to me through the Evergreens? He's saying in this article, pretty soon we're going to have an extension of consciousness. He said to me in the Evergreens that he didn't realize that management could block the natural of speedy evolution that was coming so effectively.
Big oil.
Yeah, big oil, or just be stupid. And you know, and not do anything. And then supposedly all the bad pollution, everything just piles up. And now they've got a bad president. They're trying to say the Republican agenda for the last 40 years needed to have Trump. And Trump was the fulfillment of all the implications of what they said.
Oh, really? Oh, really? I haven't read that one. That's...
Yeah, the racist part of the Republican Party, the latent parts, all has come out with Trump, and he's given them what they deserve. But now he's gone beyond what they thought they deserved, and now they say, we got to get rid of this guy. And somebody says, little from column A, little from column B. Is that accountant talk, Carolyn? little from column A, a little from column B. Yeah, that's, if you look at it as a visual mapping, a visual accounting of the effects, you say a little bit from column A, the form, a little bit from the dialectics, column B.
Well, it appears that any bureaucracy just wants to keep the status quo so that nothing will get done. I remember...
Well, the status quo is you being in power, is the person having the wherewithal to put the to hold the gun at you. And I've got the gun, you don't, so you sit there and you mow the lawn, not me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's over death. Mm-hmm. If the person who has being who has a gun aimed at them doesn't care about being shot, then the guy has no power.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, since 500 years, it's been might. But maybe it was might all along. Every tribal thing was just a battle of might.
Yeah.
Now, that makes reality boring,
now the
though.
Mighty, now the mighty is, that's what I kind of, I imagine Trump as the businessman going in and he's going to, you know, do government like business. And so he's going through this fate now where, that I even read an article where they were saying it, he's just firing everybody and bringing in somebody else, like a new manager. And
yeah.
The result is he's seeing how ingrained and how...
non-business-like the world is.
How frozen bureaucracy is, how government is so ingrained because there's people that have been there for a long time that, you know, are going to keep that system in place. And it's just pissing him off royally, you know. And so he twitters about it and then, you know, fires the next person. Now he's bringing in, what, a military? Kelly is chief of staff. Now the big guns are coming in.
Get a general. So let's go back to the article. We've wandered well enough. We need to get back on focus here of the language of forms. So what did I get to? Yes, I did the mathematics. I did that. Well, it's graduate level in mathematics. The grades 5 and 6 are now doing the graduate level of mathematics. What was the graduate level?
What was that word?
Secany, S-E-C-A-N-Y. S-E-C-A-N-Y, secany. I don't know what that is. Maybe you could Google it, see if this an actual word comes up. Could be misspelled. So,
I tried before, but it might have been a difference. Yeah.
Okay, here we go. If you have the whole world, a total field to work in, a field, after all, is a normal term, a Norman term out of physics. If you have the whole planet as field, then the role of student is hunter. The condition of the student today is to return to the condition of hunter. Now the hunter is never a specialist. You got to mute, Carol.
Hmm.
Now the hunter is never a specialist. He never studied anything. You have to take the total environment as his subject. And this, I think, is the inevitable consequence of speed-ups of the total field. And the student's role is not to acquire classified data about any part of that field, but to be a hunter in that field. Now, what society... based on the might is right thing, it's going to let people wander around hunting. They're going to force them to do some dinky specialist job, right?